You may be seated. Thank you. The next case set for argument this morning is Ronald and Kristen Stack versus James Garrett et al. Elliot Bloom is present on behalf of the Garrett's appellants. We'll be arguing, and Andrew Hurd is arguing on behalf of the appellees, the Stacks. Each side will have 15 minutes for your initial argument, and then, Mr. Bloom, you'll have a five-minute rebuttal. You can proceed, Mr. Bloom, with your argument.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Mr. Chief Justice, my colleague, may it please the court, my name is Elliot Bloom, and I represent the appellants in this matter, James, Sandra, and Levi Garrett. There are three issues, main issues, before the court today. Those being whether the circuit court erred in denying defendants' motion for a judgment for a new trial or a judgment as a matter of law when the plaintiffs did not abide by the notice provision in the farm lease agreement. The second issue before this court is whether the circuit court erred in denying the defendants' motion to dismiss when the Garretts were not properly served with a three-day notice to quit, failure to mediate precluded the action, and the plaintiff failed to give proper notice of default and parallel litigation existed. And finally, whether the circuit court erred in rejecting the Garretts' proposed instruction providing that Section 12 of the farm lease agreement required the plaintiffs to provide a proper notice of default to allow the Garretts to cure. Today we ask the court to reverse the lower court's ruling on the aforementioned issues. However, this court also tasked counsel to address the jurisdictional status of this appeal. As outlined in the briefings, this appeal before the court is believed to be proper. Plaintiffs based their motion on a 1952 case of Wilgie v. Kropp. In that case, the court analyzed the 1939 code SDC 33.071, where the court ruled because the statute did not allow for the court to hear orders denying a new trial, the appeal was dismissed. However, in 2007, the court relaxed that rule and that holding, where the court addressed in the 2007 case of Johnson v. Liebert that the appeals on the motion can still be heard. The court is just directed to hear the appeal on that motion and whether the post-trial motion was proper. Here, the judgment of eviction was entered on December 9, 2022. The Garretts filed the motion for judgment for a new trial and a motion for judgment as a matter of law on December 14. It was not until the court could not hear the motion and deny them until January 11, 2003, and the appeal was then taken in February. It would have been self-defeating in our case to bring a motion or an appeal, notice of appeal on the judgment right away, because it would have taken the jurisdiction away from the lower court, where when you appeal, it does strip the circuit court's jurisdiction to hear.
But the issue here is not timeliness. The issue is, did you appeal the right order? That's really the issue. So in other words, you could have delayed appealing that underlying judgment. It's a question of whether you appealed the right order.
You're correct, Chief Justice, and the timeliness in this one is not an issue like it was in Johnson. The court also asked to address SDCL 26A-4, which has been implemented since the Wilgie case. In that case, it gives the court discretion to allow the appeal to go forward on the mere technicality of not having the word judgment in the notice of appeal. In Section 4 of that 26A, the court is allowed, as long as the timeliness is correct and the notice is properly served, the court has discretion to hear this appeal. Getting to the first main issue in terms of judgment, whether the judgment as a matter of law was warranted when the plaintiffs failed to abide by the notice agreement, matters of contract interpretation are questions of law reviewed de novo. And when interpreting a contract, this court looks to the language of the party that the parties use and determine their intention. Terms and conditions of contract are examined as a whole, with words giving their plain meaning. Here, the farm lease agreement contained two provisions that are pertinent here. Section 12 stated that in case of a default in the payment of any lease, the lessee shall have the right to cure the default or breach upon the same being corrected upon 60 days' notice. Then in Section 13, right below it of the same agreement, it states that the parties agree that the notice required or permitted shall be made by the escrow agent, here Bank West. These two sections are clear and unambiguous. If the Garretts missed a payment or breached the agreement, they had 60 days to cure the breach upon the proper notice from the escrow agreement. Now, my colleague in the brief indicated that there is ambiguity in terms of all other the three agreements having sections indicating that the lease terminated automatically when the lease payment was not directed on June 20th. But that all those agreements don't take, or all those sections that are raised by my colleague does not take into account the default provision. The lease can be terminated, but it still, on the notice provision, allows my client the 60 days to cure that default.
But even under that notice provision, Garretts were given notice August 27th, told they had to pay it by October 15th, but the notice says it doesn't expire until March 1st, the lease. So weren't Garretts really given, what's that, about 6 months before the lease actually expired? And then you look at the terms of the agreement that say, if the default continues for more than 60 days after written notice, then this lease shall terminate at the option of the lessor. So don't you have a lot more than 60 days notice before the lease was actually terminated?
No, Chief Justice. In terms of that August 27th letter, Mr. Stock gave the Garretts less than the 60 days notice to actually cure their default, indicating that they needed to make a payment by October 15th. He then stated in that letter that the lease would terminate in March, but only gave less than the 60 days.
But did the lease terminate on October 15th?
In terms of, no, Your Honor, it
did. Did the Stocks take any action to terminate the lease on October 15th?
No, Your Honor, they didn't.
First thing they did, in fact, actually, they didn't even do the three-day notice till what, June or July the following year?
July 1st, yes, Your Honor. The August letter, after the August letter was sent, Mr. Stock, as the record will reflect, called the Garretts, indicating that he needed a payment and to give him a partial payment due in November. Now, the Garretts did make that payment in November, even though Ronald wanted it in October. And it wasn't till, again, as the record reflected, that the frustration of the mortgage payment, where Stock in that year made the mortgage payment early on October 29th, the Garretts payment again in November couldn't be delivered to the bank. Robbo accepted it, but it was never cashed in the year of 2021. On cross-examination and rebuttal during the trial, Mr. Stock admitted that he didn't provide the notice pursuant to the agreements. The escrow agent admitted not to providing a notice pursuant to the agreements. This court stated in Hine v. Martz that it is crucial that strict compliance with notice provisions be had where the notice affects property rights and where it is to form the basis of a suit. And here, we don't have a typical landlord-tenant scenario. This is more like a financier, I would say, where Mr. Stock was acting at the bank. The Garretts had the ability to purchase the property. The agreements were put in place to essentially get their credit up. The ranch has been in this family for 140 years. It was never intended for Mr. Stock to keep this land. Likewise, in terms of why this notice is so important in terms of property rights, the Court of Appeals of Georgia's case in Woodall v. Farr is very instructive. There, the court indicated that a forfeiture, where a contract calls for forfeiture, the notice of default provisions must appear that the notice was given in strict compliance with the contract, both as into time and of to contents. and here that was not given. And that is why we'd ask this court to reverse the motion for judgment as a matter of law, both as to after the trial and during. The second issue before the court is whether the circuit court erred in denying the Garrett's motion to dismiss when the Garrett's were not properly served, failed to mediate, precluded the action, failure of the Stocks to, again, provide notice of default, and parallel litigation existed. Regarding the improper service under SDCL 2116-2, that statute states that all cases arising under 2116-1, Section 4, 5, and 6, three-day notice to quit is required and must be given to the lessee before a proceeding can be situated. SDCL 1566 puts forth the calculating time period for that three-day notice. In my colleague's brief, they indicate that 1566 doesn't apply to the eviction matters. We would argue that it does. In terms of the statute that they bring up is in terms of the inconsistency of the civil rules of procedure applying to the special proceedings of an eviction. And the statute indicates whether the civil rules of procedure are inconsistent with that. We would argue that 1566 in terms of the time period is not inconsistent. When you look at a relatively old case of Measure v. Stoner, which this court decided in 1926, under the old statutory scheme for evictions, the facts of that case was an eviction case. And the landlord did not give the proper three-day notice to quit. The time period noted in that case under the older statute, Section 10665 RC, calculated the time similar to SDCL 6.-6, indicating that you don't take the time of the event and holidays are not counted. And this is what we have here. The three-day notice to quit was served on July 1st, 2022. That was a Friday. We have Saturday, Sunday, and Monday was July 4th. The three-day notice didn't start until July 5th. However, on July 6th, Mr. Stock served the summons and complaint on Mr. Stock. We argued this in front of the circuit court, indicating that jurisdiction did not lie with the circuit court regarding the lack of the three-day notice.
Do you think that's subject matter or personal jurisdiction?
Subject matter, Chief Justice. As that 1926 case of
The case isn't very clear what they're talking about, is it?
It is not very clear, Chief Justice. And the case is really short in terms of they didn't really get into the jurisdictional argument of whether it was personal or subject matter.
Do you think it's subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes.
And so if that's the case, we look at 2116-2, that simply says you got to serve it, you got to get 3 days notice. There's no time computation, there's no additional time for weekends, holidays, anything like that. And I understand your argument about 15681, but what about 15-6-1, which says this chapter governs the procedure of civil courts of the South Dakota in all suits of civil nature? You know, this 3 day notice is prior to any suit. Are we even to the point of where the rules of civil procedure apply on a pre-suit 3 day notice to quit?
Yes, I believe so, Your Honor. Because it's jurisdictional, we need a time frame, and without
the statute says 3 days. Yeah. It says 3 days.
You're correct, Chief Justice, and
so you want to add the computation, which the statute doesn't allow. The question is, can you bring in that 15-6-6 computation time in view of both, whether it's 15-6-81 or 15-6-1?
I believe we have to, Chief Justice, bring in some type of time requirement. If that was the case, every landlord would file their notice to quit on a Friday, giving less time over the weekend, even when mail not going out on Sunday. There has to be some type of time that's not indicated in the special proceedings of eviction, and the only other time requirement in terms of computing time is the Rule of Civil Procedure 1566. But I understand, Chief Justice, that there is no requirement. It just says 3 days notice. But I think it would be an injustice to allow landlords, in terms of a public policy argument, to just have a 3 days no matter when it is.
And the statute contemplates an imminent civil action, an imminent federal or forcible entry and detainer action. So that's very much a precursor to litigation.
You're correct, Mr. Salter. And we see this in another interesting part of the statutory scheme where under 4, 5, and 6 of subsection of the eviction matters of how you can bring an eviction is where we don't need a 3-day notice to quit when waste is alleged. Well, if my colleague's argument is that they allege waste in one sentence of their complaint. However, in the complaint, they also say that it's getting brought under subsection 4 of the eviction proceedings, indicating that it's a failure to pay rent. They indicated in their complaint that a 3-day notice was given. It's only now that we're getting this argument that, well, a waste was alleged. Well, again, I would say public policy would indicate...
Time is up, Mr.
Oh, thank you.
Mr. Hurd, you can proceed with your argument.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court. My name is Drew Hurd, and I represent the appellees, Ron and Kristen Stock. As a little background to this, the Stocks got involved with the Garretts through a mutual friend of theirs, John Eric, who is a realtor up in South Dakota, who Ron knew through some business dealings through an auction company that Ron owns that specializes in selling agricultural equipment and ag land. John Eric was apparently going to do some kind of deal with the Garretts where he was going to buy some of their land and help them out while they were in some financial straits. For one reason or another, Mr. Eric decided he was not going to go through with the deal, but he contacted my client, Ron Stock, and told him that the Garretts are good people, they've fallen on hard times, and I think you should do this deal. Ron contacted the Garretts, and apparently the financial straits were so dire that the option that they chose was to sell their entire farm to Mr. Stock and his wife in fee with a lease back and potential option to purchase at the end. Pretty quickly, the Garretts were to make annual lease payments. Pretty quickly into this agreement, they were not making them per the agreement. They concocted a whole number of theories as to why they shouldn't have to pay them or that Ron Stock somehow blocked payments or whatever, but all of those were ultimately rejected by the jury during the 2-day trial last December. The Garretts then filed post-trial motions, predominantly on the 45-day, 60-day notice issue. Those motions were denied, and it's from the order denying those motions that the Garretts now appeal. The court in both Wilgie v. Crop and Johnson is very clear that that is not an order that this court has jurisdiction to hear. The Garretts point to the second-to-last sentence in Johnson, which I think standing on alone is admittedly confusing, but if you read it in context with the whole opinion, what the court is really saying is if we take an appeal from a motion notwithstanding the verdict motion for judgment as a matter of law, all we will be reviewing is whether or not that motion should be granted. The sentence before it, though, is that no matter what we do, it won't resurrect the judgment. So I think the court's not relaxing the standard from Wilgie in that sentence. I think the court's explaining, look, what's really being asked of us is to issue an advisory opinion on whatever legal issue is present in the motion for judgment as a matter of law. But without being able to change or resurrect the verdict, I think there's probably a standing issue at that point. I don't think there's a live controversy if that's the case. So, you know, with all respect and reverence to this court, it just lacks the jurisdiction to hear the claims that the Garretts have appealed from, and it also lacks the authority to sua sponte notice an issue for appeal that the Garretts haven't raised themselves.
So Garretts argue that, you know, this is just really a technical defect, and we've got some of those cases that say we're going to liberally construe notices of appeal, and if there's a mistake in it, we're going to construe that so it doesn't result in a dismissal, unfair dismissal. Why does that not apply here?
Well, I think, you know, first, there is a statute, 1626A 4.1, does permit, I believe it permits the parties to amend their notice. I'd have to read it again. I don't know that it permits the court to sua sponte amend their notice. But the other thing is the sort of relaxed standard under 1526A4, right? It says, you know, failure to comply with any of these things above doesn't necessarily result in dismissal. But I think the predicate to getting to 1526A4 is you have to have appealed something under sub 3. And none of the orders noticed, and even arguably noticed with the motion to dismiss, which isn't actually stated in the notice but was affixed thereto, none of those orders are final orders that can be appealed from. So the court would, I mean, essentially be, because I think, too, if the court were to accept that argument, it would essentially be changing the language of 1526A3 to say, because right now what it says is, here is a list of orders you can appeal from. I think if the court were to grant the Garretts the relief they're seeking, it'd essentially be changing sub 3 to say, in any case where a final order has been entered, you can appeal from whatever you want from in it. I think that would also get rid of the point of 1526A7, which is the statute which says appeals from the judgment permit a party to appeal from any of the intermediate orders therein, and that's how you get to 1526A9, which says if you appeal from the judgment, then you can appeal from an order denying your motion for a new trial. I think it would render big chunks of 1526A, at least at the initial standpoint, just superfluous if the court was able to resurrect the judgment, so to speak, using the Johnson court's language on its own without the parties having noticed it properly for appeal.
So with regard to the liberal construction, you know, you referenced orders attached. Do you think a liberal construction would allow the court to look at the contemporaneous filings with the notice of appeal?
Such as, like, the docketing statement?
Yes, and that's kind of what, because the docketing statement identifies the judgment as one of the things when it's laying out the issue statements.
See, I could totally be wrong, Justice Devaney, and forgive me if I am. I, having read through their issues on appeal again, it looks to me like their issues are basically copy and pasted from the issues that are in their brief, which are motion for judgment as a matter of law, motion to dismiss, and then sort of generally they have their jury instruction one, which...
It may not be the issue statements, and I don't have it in front of me right now either. My recollection is that the docketing statement referred to the judgment, the eviction judgment, but...
That may be true. I don't know, Justice Devaney. I'm sorry.
Isn't that enough if it does? I mean, doesn't it clarify what the intent to appeal from is in the case?
I don't think that substantial compliance, though, is the rule, at least in this particular legal instance. I think, you know, that we were on notice, because what the Johnson case talks about is a properly perfected appeal from the judgment.
So just to be clear, this up, I mean, the docketing statement says that identifies January 11th, 2023 as the date of the judgment or order from which it's applied. So it's January 11th, 2023.
The judgment of eviction was entered, I believe, on December 7th. So I'm...
9th, the notice of entry on December 9th, I think. But, yeah.
Oh, okay. Oh, November, or December 9th.
Yeah, it says January 11th, 2023, so I don't know what the...
See, and that, to me, my memory may be wrong. I think that's talking about one of the post-trial motions orders, though.
Yeah, I mean, that was my thought. I mean, that's not the judgment. The judgment was earlier than that, December, so...
That's right, Justice Salter. And I believe I could look through the file. I want to say notice of entry of that judgment, though, was served within a couple days of that jury trial. I want to say December 9th, but off the top of my head, I'm not entirely clear on it. But the court in the past, in the statutes in the past. Because the other thing, too, about, you know, like, for instance, Wilgie, because in Johnson there's a timing issue that's not here. Wilgie, however, does not talk about any sort of timing issues. And the court in Wilgie is very express in that the court lacks jurisdiction to hear appeals from judgments denying motions for judgment as a matter of law. And then there's a number of cases, Ryan versus Davenport, DeBoard versus Brandt, I think is another one we cited. Those both unequivocally say that you can't appeal from an order denying a motion to dismiss.
The 11th order was the date that the order for judgment as a matter of law and order for new trial was denied.
So I think, you know, I don't think it was properly appealed from. I don't think it was properly noticed. I think that there are strict rules in this regard for a reason. I can't pull the case name off the top of my head, but I believe just last year, Justice Salter, you wrote an opinion about the requirements of strict compliance with the statutes. The Stromberger case says this court doesn't have authority to do anything that is not conferred to it by statute. We simply just don't have compliance with 1526A3 here. And like Wilgie and Johnson, there's no dispute that there was a judgment that was entered. That wasn't an issue in Wilgie. In Johnson, I think you had a pro se litigant, and that's why you had issues. But in Wilgie, there's no such issue talked about.
Counsel, you don't have a lot of time left, and I just wanted to ask some of the questions with regard to the merits.
Absolutely.
I'm trying to, and I haven't completely read this record, but it wasn't entirely clear to me as to what the jury was allowed to consider with regard to the notice provision that is at issue here. Was it made clear to the jury whether or not that provision applied? I guess I'll start there. And how was it presented to the jury?
Sure. I think that's kind of an interesting question, Justice Devaney, because the way other jury instructions came out and because of the way we're operating on a general verdict form, I think the court's review of what the jury actually did is fairly limited by that fact.
I'm trying to figure out what was presented to them.
Understood. So you, when looking through this transcript, I mean, like the Garrett stated, during cross-examination, Ron Stock did talk about the notice. The notice that Ron Stock provided was in evidence. The lease agreements, there's three of them, only one of them is called a lease agreement, but they basically all are read in conjunction.
I'm going to narrow. I'm sorry, because we're not so much as a matter of fact, but as a matter of law, what is your understanding of what they were instructed with regard to how that notice provision comes into play here?
Well, so during closing, the Garretts certainly argued that the failure to provide the 45-day notice was a material breach that relieved them of the requirement that they pay rent. The jury was instructed, there's one instruction, I believe it's 11, which laid out each party's sort of theory of material breach. And the Garretts included a couple of them in there and then didn't ultimately object to the instruction. It was kind of a jointly crafted instruction. And I think the instructions include other instructions throughout, which say things like, if the Garretts have proven that the Stocks have committed a breach so as to relieve them of the obligation to pay rent, you must fine for the Garretts. They were instructed on things like that. Testimony came in on that issue. Closing argument was made on that issue. The jury was never instructed that they could not consider it. I think, you know, instruction number 11, or excuse me, 12, I believe it is, instructs on the sort of legal theory of futility. I think that's a proper instruction for the jury to consider. Considering that the Garretts had filed suit against the Stocks as sort of a preemptive strike, 7 months before the eviction proceeding. I think that jury properly was able to consider everything. Here's one of the issues, though, too, is that the Garretts offered, and the jury was instructed, I think it's number 5, on the theory of implied contracts. I think given that instruction and the general verdict form, it's kind of hard to say whether the jury even thought that the notice provision was ultimately part of the contract. Because, the record is replete with both parties doing things that aren't contemplated by the contract. Certain formalities weren't followed by both sides. The jury may have just found that the parties were operating on a sort of, email-by-email basis. I mean, we just really don't know what it is that the jury ultimately thought about that notice provision. But it was certainly tried to them, and they were certainly instructed that if they found that the stocks had prevented them from making payments or had otherwise breached, that it would relieve the Garris of their requirement to pay rent.
Had neither party proposed a special verdict?
No, the Garris proposed a general verdict form.
Okay.
I do want
to... Mr. Hurd, I wanted to ask you about... I know it didn't come up in Mr. Bloom's argument, but the claim splitting theory, you know, we've not recognized that in South Dakota, but there's a number of cases that are cited for federal courts and other jurisdictions. Tell me why you don't think that theory applies in this instance.
Sure. So I'd like to start by saying that the claim is undoubtedly split. We have split our claim for immediate possession at the expedited state court action, and there is a claim for damages in the federal court. That is expressly permitted by 2116.4, which says that no other claim may be brought with the action for possession, but the plaintiff may, if he so chooses, bring a claim for rents, or he can bring it in a separate action. That's what happened. So the claim is split, and the statute permits that. So I think the issue of parallel litigation, though, in that Frucon case, the stocks claims in state court and federal court were not the same. They seek different relief. Now, the black and white of the pleadings themselves, if you just look at them together, seem to look congruent. Almost immediately, though, into the state court proceedings, Judge Klinger made a ruling, and we withdrew our claim for damages in the state court action, and it was immediately decided that possession was all we were going to be pursuing. Mr. Chief Justice, may I finish? Our claim in federal court for damages is alive and well. It is still a live claim in front of Judge Lang right now.
And how about the Garrett's claim? Because they've got some damage claims too. Do you think those are all alive and well?
I think it depends
how those are precluded now.
Well, their theories of material breach are precluded. Well, one thing I want to note though is the parallel litigation cases are about what claims can the stocks bring. So the stocks claims are not the same. Just because they are somewhat congruent with the Garrett's claims in federal court does not make it claims or parallel litigation. It's supposed to prevent an individual litigant from harassing someone else by filing multiple claims in different places. At the federal court, the theory that the stocks had materially breached the agreement was tossed on res judicata grounds, because although we don't exactly know what the jury found in the state court case because of the general verdict form, we know certainly that they must have found that the Garrett's materially breached so as to deprive them of their rights under the lease, and that the stocks didn't do anything which would have permitted them to materially breach. I don't, however, think that those... they may still have contract defenses to our damages claims. Things like the fence being moved or things like that, those may be affirmative defenses that they can still plead as to, you know, mitigating their damages or reducing what they owe in rent. In terms of whether the stocks are materially breached, the jury's decision in the state court action did decide that issue for the federal court. But ultimately, the stocks claims in both actions are different, and that's what the parallel litigation claims are looking at. Not whether the opposing party may have claims which are disposed of on res judicata grounds, but whether the actual pleading party itself has pled the same thing in two different courts, and that's not the case here. Or at least that's not how it was tried, and it was almost immediate that our claim for damages in the state court action was withdrawn, and Judge Klinger made it very clear from the beginning to the end of trial that possession was all that was going to be tried. If the court doesn't have any more questions, I would ask that the court dismiss this appeal or alternatively affirm the circuit court's ruling. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Hurd. Mr. Boyle, you can proceed with rebuttal.
Thank you, Chief Justice. I'd like to go back to your question regarding the claim splitting issue. What's really instructive in terms of the factors that we're asking this court to look at least from the Eighth Circuit, in the case coming down from Frucon Construction versus Controlled Air, where the Eighth Circuit lays out this parallel litigation factors. One of those factors is the prejudice to the plaintiff. Here, we need to look at the parallel litigation issue at the time the motion to dismiss was entered. The pleadings looked the exact same, which we indicated in our brief. And what's really instructive is now we have the Garrett's claims in the federal court action being dismissed based on a partial summary judgment motion because they relied on a res judicata issue on the eviction.
How would you ultimately, even if you were correct in that argument, prejudice when the matter did go to trial then with regard to possession?
Yes,
the
Justice.
Breach issue.
Yes, Justice Devaney. We don't really, it's our argument that the jury didn't really look at breach. It was just possession, as the jury verdict form looked at, is who had possession of the land.
Well, doesn't breach come into play there?
The instructions indicate that in whether who breached first, material breaching, and the jury could have relied on that instruction. We don't know, and I think that was one of the main issues of the jury instructions and why we think the notice provision instruction should have been given. In terms of the federal lawsuit, in which Garrett's filed first in this matter, would have more adequately addressed these complicated claims. We would have been able to depose the parties. We would have been able to conduct more formal discovery on this complicated matter. Instead, now we have a special proceeding under an eviction where there is no discovery, and now it's being used as a res judicata effect to get rid of the Garrett's claims in the federal court action. So I think the favorability in terms of the last factor in terms of parallel litigation weighs heavily in favor of the Garrett's in terms of determining that there was parallel litigation. And again, at the time that motion to dismiss, the Garrett's claims and the Stock's counterclaims in the federal action matched exactly to what was being asked for in terms of release in the eviction matter when the summons and complaint was put in. It was only later on that they started whittling away those claims of damages of just possession. And Justice Devaney, I'd like to go back to your question regarding the notice provision and what the jury was instructed. The jury was not instructed in terms of what the effect of that notice provision was. What the jury was instructed, which we're not claiming was an error, because I think it is a correct statement of the law, was jury instruction number 12 in terms of when a breaching party has abandoned the contract and evidenced a clear and unequivocal intent not to complete the contract, a cure notice is not required. The law does not require futile or meaningful acts where it would prove meaningless to provide a party with written notice of a breach. A cure is not required. Now, that's a correct statement of the law. We believe that no party argued abandonment during trial. But when you buttress that instruction to the rejection of our proposed instruction that if you find that notice wasn't provided, you have to file or rule for the defense, the jury could only find that they abandoned the contract. And that's why we think that the instruction of not giving our instruction in terms of what that notice meant. The court was...
But in the end, isn't really all of that a legal question that's bound up in your motion that you made to dismiss because of the fact that as a matter of law they didn't comply with the contract? Court should have granted that, shouldn't even have gone to a jury. I mean, really, that isn't really your issue here, a legal one, not a factual one at all.
You're exactly right, Chief Justice. At the end of the day, the jury should have never heard this action. At the time of trial, when testimony was gathered that Stock did not abide by the notice provision, that the escrow agent did not send the notice pursuant to Section 12 of the Farm Lease or Section 13 of the Farm Lease Agreement. At that point, we had the evidence, because no depositions were taken, to ask for that judgment as a matter of law. And for those reasons, Your Honor, we would ask that, or justices, that you reverse the circuit court on the aforementioned reasons. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel, for your arguments. That will conclude our November term of court, and we'll be in recess. Thank you.